I did not feel the slightest motion when the ship climbed up and swiftly shot up into the night sky. Only on the different viewing screens I saw the starting maneuver and the fast flight away. Otherwise nothing new happened. The ship became neither transparent nor did it shine. It just remained as it was, solid, tangible, and very stable. During the flight no word was spoken and Arskit occupied herself calmly with the various control apparatus. Then I saw on the viewing screen, deep below us, visible mountain contours, towards which we seemed to rush down. Without feeling any discomfort, the ship stopped quite suddenly out of its rushing speed, and it just remained hanging in the air for some minutes. Then it slowly started to move again, and floated softly down to earth, like a feather. Mir continued his explanation. When we let ourselves be transported out of the ship, I noticed that we were again at the same location, where only a few days before we had met. Contrary to Europe, the weather was very mild here. High in the heavens thousands of stars flashed and different voices of the night could be heard. I felt secure and glad to be here. Slowly Arskit and I wandered through the rocky wilderness, and then sat down on a big flat stone. Here Arskit began to speak for some time. Arskit, the time has now, 1956, come for you to experience many things, which for you, and others some later, will be useful in the search for truth. I have told you of the possibility of time travel into the past or the future. According to our technology, we have the ability to undertake such journeys, and to bring them now into use for the benefit of your mission. As it is decided, you will travel back with me into different time epochs, to be able to examine the truth of events in their places and locations of occurrence, and to see that your traditions and the affirmations of your own history are incorrect, and actually agree with the true events only on rare occasions. You have been informed about the course of your life, which will be troublesome and difficult. But the time of your lessons has not yet finished, because it will last another 20 years, which you will experience as heavy times of enormous hardship. Though up to now it has been difficult, it will become still more so in the future. But, be yourself conscious of the necessity of having to finish these educations, as just for your task. The next years will be bring you into prison, and into war services outside of your homeland. You will have to acquit all stations of a fighting man to know and understand all very thoroughly. For if you are to undertake the matter, you can only do so having experienced everything by yourself. Likewise it will also be with some passions, in which you will indulge. As well, heavy body pain will not be spared you, nor psychic pain. You will think that you have lived in hell, but by that you will learn to understand the heaven. Already now I want to tell you that within less than 10 years, you will have to pass the, until then hardest termination of your life. Yet this examination in your fate will be necessary to collect much understanding. I know your distant future, for I have penetrated it, that many evil things will befall you. A great change will come over your body, thus, suddenly you will start to lead a completely new life. For this moment now, it will sound very hard for you. But so it must indeed be, and we are not able to change your fate, because this is not within our power. It will be good for you to prepare yourself for the coming event, and to meet the facts with a clear head. For only you are able to do that, and I want to explain what is coming. The further occurrences of your own future are the following, but which you shall not tell anybody. Future events mentioned. Further events will be that in a short time before the loss of your arm in Persia, you will find a new identification in the name of Billy. The name has meaning in it that will weigh heavily on you. Your provided name Billy will become known worldwide. Until then, you will be completely on your own. And during this time you will get no further instructions or lessons from us. This is the last and most difficult lesson you will have to overcome alone. The struggle for truth will be difficult, because you will have to confront the opposition of the UFO groups, being strongly established within their beliefs. You will be hated worldwide, and your life will be threatened. But nevertheless, do work fast and precisely to fulfill your mission, as the time runs fast and the death of your body cannot be delayed. He was then told when and how he will die, which he is not allowed to reveal. Concerning this contact with Ascot on the 8th of February 1956, Meir wrote, "The process of the transmission in time travel took about 10 minutes, while the actual jump over lasted only a fraction of a second to go from one time to another. The what and how of the technique was never explained by Ascot. At the beginning of a transmission, something astonishing occurred in that the whole surroundings of the ship grew slowly dim to exist no more. I noticed the same process within myself as well, and in the moment of leap, it was suddenly replaced by something else. Ascot guided into different time epochs, both back into the past and into the future. I saw and experienced many events there which can never be agreed to by historians and scientists of other branches. I had to recognize that many scientific theses of our time are just that, theses alone, and are far from the real truth, especially respecting many events and occurrences in the past. And I also saw that many natural scientific events were completely different from what some of our scientists advocate. The different time travels are not allowed to be closer reported, because they hide deep truths in themselves which must remain forever hidden. Ascot has permitted that a quite certain event may be reported, being of important consequence to what is happening today. On the 11th of February 1956, still on a continuation of the pickup on 8 February, during a time trip to Death Valley in California, Ascot had this to say, Ascot, you wonder about very many things that I tell you. Your assumption is not correct, as the horse was not brought from Europe to Asia. Just the opposite is correct, all horses of this world were created on this continent, North America, which you call America. This continent was until around 50,000 years back in your chronology, inhabited by human beings, by universe travelers and their descendants. As usual in this world, they quarreled with one another and destroyed themselves and the others. They invented an atomic bomb and exploded it in a flash war. The effect was cataclysmic and it depopulated this whole continent, and different sorts of animals as well, such as the horse, were completely eradicated. As far as I know, you called this sort of horse of that time the Hipparion. Even today, after 50,000 years, you still call certain regions of this continent in the same manner as they were once called in those other times. The names were carried forward to present time, as well as some evidences of that unreasonably insane and barbarous time still exist. The one who wants to see these can examine and make judgments about them for himself. These are the places of ancient cities, which many thousands of years ago stood on those sites, and which in atomic hells were melted down into glass-like masses. The best preserved proofs have become a curiosity in your time, because the Earthman does not know their origin. Well known are those in this respect still under the name Death Valley, which also is still connected with other events of the present time. The Fire Valley near the city of Las Vegas is another witness to the past and timeless atomic insanity of the Earth human being. Atomic war is not new to this modern generation of humanity. The dangerous atomic sciences have been discovered and employed on Earth before, and never yet has Earthman failed to destroy himself and his entire civilization, even on a worldwide scale along with him. It has never assisted humanity to newer and loftier goals. Some other sites of waste residue left by prehistoric atomic blasts may be found in Monument Valley, Arizona, the Bica Valley in Lebanon, the West Australian Desert, and northwest of Cuenca, Ecuador, and there are more. Meir says, Ascot furnished many other explanations, but which I am not permitted to tell. They deal, without exception, with events of the past which will not have full meaning until the future. How those events are connected to and influence the future was explained. This time travel visit to sites of earlier atomic devastation in conflicts that wiped out entire cities is of special interest to our society in this modern age, and of particular interest to some of the investigators in this case, because we have personal knowledge of and have handled evidence of the ruins of such a blast of stupendous magnitude on the eastern slopes of the Andes a few dozen miles northeast of Cuenca, Ecuador. The best estimate of time of that event that we have been able to obtain, based on specimens of the vitrified waste material brought back in 1972, was that the pumice block was subjected to such heat that it turned it to glass somewhere between 6,000 up to 12,000 years ago. We then undertook a search for supporting evidence and found a good deal. Mia was told that the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah was from a similar blast, and we may observe that some of the purification rites described in the Old Testament sound very much like radiation decontamination, and radiation effects and their treatment today. The Ramayana, an epic poem of ancient India, variously dated from 500 BC to as far back as 3000 BC, is a collection of historical legend narrated by the Indian sage, Narada, to the court historian Valmiki. These are the pearls of wisdom which inspire certain Indian sects today. It describes, among other things, Rama, son of Dasaratha, king of Ayodhya, in northern India, as dueling with Ravana in celestial cars, fighting in the sky, and of destroying Ravana in Lanka, a former continent in the Indian Ocean, the remains of which are now known as Ceylon, with atomic missiles. Rama's father, King Dasaratha, was said to have sprung from an ancient star race, descendants of the kings of the stars, space beings, who ruled India then. These celestial cars were circular in shape, golden in color and radiant to look upon, and were drawn by steeds like the solar ray. After the death of his wife, Sita, Rama lived alone and held secret conferences with a heavenly messenger, like the biblical prophets meeting the Lord. Years later, Rama left Ayodhya in a celestial car and entered heaven. Here we have another direct assumption into heaven in the manner of our own biblical Eliya. Ramakandra Dikshita, in his War in Ancient India, Macmillan, London 1945, translates the Samarangana Sutradhara by King Bajedna, 11th century, as saying that there are flying machines which could attack visible and invisible objects, ascending, cruising thousands of miles in all directions in the atmosphere, and even mounting to the stellar regions, deep space. The Bhishma Parva, on page 44, describes the conflict between Arjuna and Bhishma, where it states that the enemy invoked a celestial weapon resembling fire in effulgence and energy. The Mahabharata, one of the oldest books in the world, describing the Bharat War in northern India, paints a picture of a great and noble civilization destroyed in an 18-day war. In one battle, reported in the Samsapta Kabada Parva, the craft are described as being circular in form and capable of forward, backward and diverse other motions. James Churchwood, in The Children of Mu, referring to millenniums-old records, claims this war was fought about 20,000 BC. Chandra Roy, in his translations from the Bhishma Parva, described the Brahma Danda, Brahma's rod, as infinitely more powerful than even Indra's bolt. The latter can strike only once, but the former can even strike whole countries and entire races from generation to generation. This sounds very much like a radiation weapon to us. The Mahabharata also describes the flying vehicles used by the invincible celestials, as the Vimana, a double-decked, circular craft with a dome having portals. It flew with the speed of the wind and gave forth a melodious sound. It could stop and remain motionless in the sky, and it soared above the clouds. From altitude the ocean looked like a small pot of water. The Vimanas were employed for sport as well as for travel and warfare, where they used the Samara, a missile that crippled, and the Moa, a weapon that produced a state of paralysis. The Bodhipava, on page 97, mentions the Vaishnava weapon which conferred invisibility, and was able to destroy in all worlds. Page 383 refers to a race-annihilating missile Bhisma. Hurled a missile that crushed, Zero King, thy soldiers in battle. And it seemed to fill the whole earth with a loud noise. And blazing forth in splendor, that fierce missile inspired thy sons with fear. Beholding that missile, with lightning flashes coursing towards them, thy warriors fled uttering frightful cries, and at the unbelievable, many men fell where they stood, and many car warriors also fell from their cars. They fought and died for their gods. The Drona Parva, on page 677, describes the Agnya weapon. Blazing with smokeless fire on all sides, showers of flaming debris, darkened sky all around, inauspicious winds began to blow, clouds roared, scorching heat by the energy of the weapon, water boiled, and warriors fell like trees in a forest fire, huge elephants fell all around. Thousands of cars fell down on all sides, air vehicles crashing, destroying everything. And both sides fought in the name of their own respective gods. Yes, there is indeed considerable confirmation of Askit's story of earlier atomic wars fought here on Earth when she took me up to one of those sites in an earlier time to show him what we have planned for ourselves, and she carefully pointed out that these terrible weapons have never been produced and not used. Edward Mir's mission is connected to this in the sense that these war energies have always been inspired or connected in some way to the advanced extraterrestrials who came here and set themselves up as gods, kings of wisdom, IHWHs, sons of God, or other similar positions, and exploited the greed and avarice of indigenous Earthmen seeking to serve them for the valuable rewards available. From these incentives spring emotional cults and political control systems out of which have evolved religions again, the emotional impetus to action. There would be less incentive to fight for somebody else and give one's life so freely if each side was not blessing their troops and promising them instant salvation if they lose their lives in these noble efforts. Whether both sides can be equally as noble at the same time raises some questions, especially since they are all referring to the same God. This also brings into question the spiritual nature of Earthman, and why does he not progress himself out of these dangerous patterns of repetition? Which is exactly what Mir sees his mission to be, to break the stranglehold on spirit and return to natural creational law as a way of life on Earth too. If you feel threatened by all this and don't like the implications of what is here indicated, join the crowd. You still have an advantage no longer available to us. You may lay this report aside and forget it forever. We no longer enjoy that luxury, for we have seen too much and experienced too much in this affair over the last 8 years to deny our own senses. We know that something is going on beyond the control of the mortal man, Edward Mir, but we do not know enough to conclusively establish anything, or to control it, or even to fully comprehend it at this time. We do not advocate the beliefs indicated, nor can we deny them. We simply do not know whether the activity is benevolent or malevolent. That, we suppose, depends upon the point of view of each individual. That something unusual is going on is no longer in doubt, but we cannot delimit it nor even adequately describe it, and we can offer no solutions to the dilemma. Many mysteries here remain unexplained, and unexplainable to our understanding. One thing we can be fairly sure of, and that is, that given enough time, the truth will come out and be recognized for what it is. We hope we live to see that day. The mission. We have come to a point we had long sought to avoid. Our simple farmer, with only a sixth grade formal education, must now be revealed as a carefully selected and uniquely trained student of religious philosophy, and trained through actual experience by those who say they are responsible for the origin of the various world belief systems, extraterrestrials, who say that their ancestors introduced and fostered these belief systems to establish and maintain control over primitive and uninformed Earth humanity. This man was, according to the extraterrestrials themselves, selected before birth, and was guided in his early development and educated by them in their own way, and was led on a personal guided tour for 12 years, through all the great religions and many others, learning them from the inside out by becoming an active participant in each in turn. His extensive special training possibly qualifies him as well as anyone to criticize, at least more so than any student of only one, two or four of these major religions. Not biased by any theological methodology or by training or profession, he was uniquely able to study them without beclouding commitment and was shown their failings, and where the different beliefs came from and why, in order to evaluate to his own satisfaction. He was then reduced to a state of non-dependency on any belief system for his own survival and forced to live by his own wits and strength alone to show him where his help really came from. Then he was reduced to a state of having nothing, and nothing to lose, and was thus given the tool with which to start his mission in the form of the UFO contacts and some evidence difficult, if not impossible to refute, but not overwhelmingly persuasive to the point of removing freedom of choice for each individual person. There are facts and there are plants in this case, forcing each to discriminate for himself every step of the way, thereby achieving the desired objective of his mission itself, that of freeing man from the bondage of dogma and urging him to know what he believes and why. He seeks to persuade Earthman to take a new look at his belief system and know why he chooses to believe a certain way, and to seek alternatives if he does not like what he sees. This is the thrust of evolution itself, which is the sum of all the individual paths through growth, knowledge, and acceptance of and by each individual in his personal and separate universe. This mission has been frequently mentioned, and is often referred to in the dialogues. Mia knows what it is and has been very thoroughly briefed on it, but is not allowed to divulge it completely to any other Earth humans. We see its highly polarizing effects, because it arouses emotional responses both ways. Some see it as a final revelation of the long beclouded truths of secular beliefs, which really are binding to its adherents, threatening to transgressors, and punitive to disbelievers. They see the ideas advocated here as the first step in releasing them from fundamentalist dogmas that require belief on faith alone and discourage legitimate questioning on the whys and wherefores of the belief. Others see it as the very work of the threatened Antichrist to tempt believers away from the security of their religions, no matter how demanding they are. Those are often held in fear, fear of the consequences of their not toeing the mark. Those are rabid in their efforts to destroy any free thinking in this respect, and they are a danger to themselves and to others, as we have personally seen in examining this case. From what we have discovered in the extensive investigations we have carried out, we deduce at least the following important elements of the mission: I to break the bondage over Earth humans by the self-proclaimed gods and sons of God, the Pleiadian IHWHs, in all mythologies and religions of the last some 70,000 years of our ancient past. Our contactee is told that he was one of them then. 2. To expose politics as an outgrowth of early religions, and to show that it should be recognized for the tool of enslavement that it really is. He is to expose this wherever possible. This, of course, now, in addition to anti-religionist, makes him to anti-capitalist, anti-communist, anti-socialist, anti-fascist and anti-political. No lack of enemies indeed. 3. To show religions as the father of politics, and fundamentalism as the greater tool of enslavement by the ancient visitors to this planet. To show religions as the institution for preserving this enslavement, primarily through fear, ignorance and intimidation, all strong motive forces indeed. Those are to be exposed for what they are. 4. To proclaim the creation, impersonal and infinite, as the true source of all life and being, with which we all are in most intimate contact every moment of existence, and which is the sun of all its infinite parts. It is in all, and all is it. With the benefit of hindsight, it is now possible to see more clearly what Mia's mission was supposed to be. It, like several other contacts by various human ETs from the Pleiades star group, was characterized by references to our common heritage with them, references to our and their ancient history, and references to the evolution of Earth's religions and politics, outgrowths of the same intent. It appears that these several contacts, in different places around the world, began their most recent phase in the mid-70s, with rapidly developing contact events and trips aboard the extraterrestrial spacecraft by the Earth contactees. Those contacts went on for years and each involved scores of witnesses and hundreds of pages of notes and dialogue in each, and each mutually unknown to each other. This is strong testimony for origin outside of either of the known groups involved. The basic message was that it is time for Earthman to change, to break his bondage to his religious and political institutions and dogma, and the ever-proliferating creation of more and more laws, all of which serve to further hold him in even greater slavery than he has ever known. He has imprisoned himself in his institutionalized fears of confinement, death, everlasting hell, and of his own fellow man, and in this fear he has the wealth and beauty of his world, deliberately planning his own suicide and the destruction of his entire world. The message is, we don't have to do this. It is all our own choice. We can change it any time we want. And nobody is ever coming from anywhere to relieve us of this responsibility. A most enlightening message indeed. Then in the beginning of the 80s, another self-professed entity from the Pleiades came to attention in Washington State, dictating the most profound and moving messages to crowds of hundreds of people. This one also described our ancient and biblical histories, and proclaimed Earthman's relationship to all. The message here is for Earthman to wake up and see what he is doing to himself, to be aware that he, and only he, can change his destiny, and that he can do overnight. On page 90 of Voyage to the New World, this communicator is quoted as saying, "You have brothers, entity, in your Pleiades, a most divine constellation. You are a divine creature. Your knowingness was absolute when you were a babe. It has been limited to the point of struggling to survive in this life without the virtue of knowingness." He simply advocates knowing what we have forgotten. This is not a welcome message to world fundamentalist and bureaucratic systems, which exist to bind and control the masses of people for the benefit of those few controllers. The danger is that the masses realize the truth of the message and refuse to accept the bondage any longer, and find that they are really free after all. We have now served our purpose in this plan, for which we also, in a way, were selected. The other side of the coin is the wave of religious fundamentalism sweeping the lands. It is paradoxical that the religious fundamentalists, each preaching peace and brotherhood, and each blessing their great armies marching off to kill in the name of their God, are the ones destined, now as always, to bring great bloodshed upon this world, and even its ultimate destruction. Salvation is not in unison, but in the unity of each individual doing what he knows is right from within. Chapter 4: Hand off to the Pleiadians. After silence and almost total absence of contact with extraterrestrial entities for nearly 10 years, they suddenly and somewhat unexpectedly returned when Sam Jays of the Pleiadian expeditionary team to this locality made her first rendezvous with Mia in a spot pre-selected by them, to which Mia was directed by inspiration. That contact was a face-to-face meeting in a wooded meadow in a forest preserve near Hinwil, where the Etkosmonaut held a lengthy conversation articulated in excellent German in Mia's familiar dialect. That meeting took place in mid-afternoon, in broad daylight, on the 28th of January 1975. After that contact, Edward, Billy, Mia sat down to write what he could remember of the remarkable exchange, and then discovered that it was coming through to him rapidly, including the whole dialogue, word for word, just as though he had recorded it. Later he found that the dialogue was in fact recorded by the extraterrestrials, and was being mechanically, telepathically played back to him from a computer-like device aboard the ship, and he was receiving it in a form of automatic writing. The writing came faster than he could normally write. Later, after Mia had been loaned a Manuel typewriter of considerable age and well used, the Pleiadians asked to borrow it for examination, and Billy took it to them on the next contact. They brought it back to him a few days later, and then Mia found that when he sat down to hunt and peck out his notes, the message came through almost as rapidly as the writing, on this old typewriter, working it with only one finger on his single hand, in a kind of automatic typing, again transmitted from the computer aboard the ship. The Pleiadians had reprogrammed it to transmit a different way. Still later, after an anonymous donor had given him an IBM Selectronic electric typewriter, the transmission of the notes was shifted to it in the same way, and Mia was able to receive the transmissions at a rate of over 60 words a minute, with one finger, under mechano, telepathic control from the ship. We have recordings of this automatic typing. As the level of imparted information increased in sensitivity, the ETs began informing Mia of certain things he could reveal to no other Earthman, things that he now needed to know for his own understanding only. Then he discovered that some of the dialogue was being left out of the text in the automatic retransmission. When he questioned this, the Pleiadians told him that they were withholding some of the sensitive information for his own good. What he did not remember could not be compromised. That resulted in one of Mia's first serious arguments with the ETs, and he finally obtained a concession from them in this respect. In these meetings with the extraterrestrials, there was a variety of exchange,